Okay, so good morning, everybody. One quick announcement, we're going to have some more theater, 9 o'clock tonight, for anybody who likes to come. As long as an audience keeps showing up, we'll just keep having theater. Just one more time, this will be the last time, I promise. This morning we're very happy to have Dror Barnaton, who will tell us about The Root and the Hidden Paradise.
Thank you. So first of all, my talk follows a handout, and I hope you all have a copy. And this is it on the screen, I hope you can all read it. There are a few changes between the screen version and the version that I printed back in Toronto. First of all, the handout itself is also available on the web. So if you look somewhere up in the corner near here, there is a definition, omega epsilon beta is equal to some URL. And all the references within the handout start with that URL, and that URL has a copy of the handout. In particular, one of the additions that's actually not in your copy is that omega epsilon beta slash pt, there is a disorganized collection of videos in a private seminar with participants, Juan, Vo, Eva, Lakiva, Esther Bazit, Travis Enns, Christine Lee, Roland van der Veen, and the Shievo Shaverling, who, Shaverling, who, what?
Scaveling.
Sorry. Who, and you can learn more about this stuff from these videos if you really, really want. There is an additional bit which was just my mandatory duty added because of that, and there is also a little bit that I've added down here. You'll see it when we come to it, and now I can really start. So, I hopefully you read my abstract, but let me read it to you again. There is expected to be a hidden paradise of polytime computable, not polynomials, just beyond the Alexander polynomial, and I will describe my brute force attempt to gain entry. So maybe, first of all, why am I expecting such a paradise? Then why is it a paradise, and then why am I a brute? So maybe I'll start from this formula here, which is the so-called Gauss diagram formula for finite type invariants. You don't need to know much about finite type invariants, but let me just say that every coefficient of every not polynomial, Alexander, Jones, Homfley, Lynx, Gould, whatever it is a finite type invariant, at least when appropriately parameterized. So basically, finite type invariants are plenty, and they come with degrees. So each one has a certain degree. The coefficient of the 17th coefficient of the Jones polynomial will be of degree 17. Okay. So now the claim is that every finite type invariant of degree d has a Gauss or has a Gauss diagram formula of degree d, and let me explain what a Gauss diagram formula of degree d is. So Vd, I'll explain that in a minute, of a not k is a sum. So to compute Vd of a not k, you look at a sum over all subsets y of the set x of k. X of k is, of course, crossings of k. So you look at all subsets of the crossings of k which are of size d. And for each such subset, you compute a function f of y, some function of this subset of the crossings. The point is, so I'm a bit schematic in this formulation, but the point is that this function should depend only on the subset y and not on all the other crossings. So it can only depend on those crossings that you've highlighted when you chose the subset y. And in fact, it can also depend on how you walk from one to the other. So right in a knot, if you walk along a knot, you visit the crossings of Y in a certain order. And then it can also depend on that, so that's why it's a bit schematic. But that's basically the point. You sum over all subsets of the crossings, which are of size D, and for each such subset, you compute a simple-minded function. Okay. This is clearly polynomial time to compute, because basically you have, if the knot has n crossing, you have n choose d subsets, and n choose d is a polynomial in n. So you basically have to compute polynomially many summons. It's also clearly finite type, because if you know the definition of finite type, basically, if you alternate over d plus 1 crossings, then every summand here is going to cover at most d of these d plus 1 crossings that you alternate over. So at least one crossing that you alternate over is not going to appear in this f of y, is not going to be visible, and then the difference between over and under will not be visible, so you'll get zero. So clearly, it's a finite type invariant. And finally, it's very tempting to guess that all polynomial time computable, and then the Haar theorem is that every finite type invariant arises this way. Okay, anyway, it's very tempting to guess that all polynomial time computable knot invariants arise in this way. In fact, let me even sketch a proof to you. Okay, so you have a polynomial time computable knot invariant. It has to treat, every invariant has to treat the crossings of a knot in a certain democratic way. So if you look at one crossing, you have to look equally much at any other crossing. And so if you look at d crossings, you have to look equally much at all other combinations of d crossings. And if you have a polynomial amount of time, you can only look, and you're willing to look at d crossings, you can only look at d crossings. You cannot look at more, because that would take more than polynomial amount of time. So basically, you just have to. So any polynomial time computable invariant would have to simply look at subsets of d crossings. If you have n to the d time, you can only look at subsets of size d. And then you just have to compute some simple-minded function for each such subset. So you get a formula like this. That, of course, is complete nonsense. Sorry, it's an appealing sketch of a proof, but you cannot turn it into a proof because it's false. And indeed, the Alexander polynomial is computable in time n to the 4, and it's infinitely many numerical invariants. Each coefficient is a numerical invariant. So the whole thing is computable in time n to the 4, and, it's infinitely many individual invariants. Okay, so let me make if you ask yourself what are all the quickly computable knot invariants, the obvious conjecture that that it's finite type invariants fails. Okay, so let me make a little table of the number of known invariants computable in time, roughly n to the power d, as a function of d for various d's. So, and the little star here is, when I say known invariants, I mean no cheating. So, I mean, I can formulate it precisely, and I don't want to, but you can easily package say infinitely many invariants within one invariant if you turn it into use some bijection between sequences of natural numbers and natural numbers. Okay? So no cheating of that kind. I can make it formal, but I don't want to. Okay? So anyway, For time n squared, there is one invariant you can compute, and it's the second coefficient of the Alexander polynomial, or the degree 2 finite type invariant. For time n cubed, there is one invariant that you can compute. For time n to the fourth, you have infinitely many invariants that you can compute, numerical invariants, meaning all the coefficients of the Jones polynomial. For time n to the five, you're down to the three finite type invariants that exist in degree 5, and then the table goes on like this. So if you think about it, this is a completely unreasonable picture. Try to think, how would one prove such a picture? There's just no mechanism that I can imagine that would prove that at n to the 4, there are infinitely many invariants, and beyond that, it drops down again to finitely many. So okay, either some magic happens, or the picture is wrong. And there are, in fact, more invariants that are computable in polynomial time, meaning quickly, and which we don't know about. So there must be more stuff computable in time n to the 5 and n to the 6 and n to the 7, and this is the hidden paradise that I'm talking about. Okay? This is my hidden paradise. I should say that there is also further evidence for the existence of these invariants by looking at the line above the Alexander line in the Melvin-Morton expansion, if you know what it is. And Lev Rozansky did a lot of work about this, so his picture is here. And the original Morton is also here somewhere, so I don't see him. Oh, here are you. And it's also related to the two-loop contribution to the Concievich integral, but again, we don't need to know about it right now. Okay, why do I call it paradise? Right, I told you that there are invariants that we don't know, that we're missing, or at least we're missing the formulas for these invariants. Maybe we know them already, but we're missing how to compute them quickly. Okay? But why is it a paradise? So the foremost answer to why is it a paradise is obviously. I mean, just think about it. I mean, just compare it with what we largely do. So I mean, largely, we work extremely hard to try to prove that some incomputable invariant A is equal to some other incomputable invariant B. Okay? I mean, if we had something we could actually compute, wouldn't it be much better? Or, you know, equally well, we struggle very hard to categorify some incomputable invariant, or practically, or maybe computable for knots with up to 10 crossings, but then we try to categorify it and we find that we can't even compute the answer for the trefoil. Or maybe we can compute it for the trefoil, but not when anything grows big. Okay? So I think it's just obvious that if you had an invariant you could actually compute, it would be good news. Maybe not paradise, but at least good news. Okay? There is a second answer which is much more subtle, and therefore I wrote it in a very, very condensed form right here, and I'm sure you can all read it and appreciate it. But if not, let me tell you that this is a page from a grant proposal I wrote not so long ago, and you can find this grant proposal in omega epsilon beta / K17, and then you can read the details. The sketch is that if you can also extend your paradise invariant to tangles, then you can perhaps use it to detect non-ribbon knots, and detecting non-ribbon knots is highly valuable because there is a conjecture called the ribbon slice conjecture, and in order to disprove this conjecture, and people believe the conjecture is actually false, you need to be able to show that certain knots are not ribbon. Let me go through it a little bit more slowly, but still too fast to really understand. So first of all, here is what a ribbon knot is. So a ribbon knot is a knot that bounds a band, shown here in blue, which is allowed to have certain type of singularity, so this is allowed, but not allowed to have another type of singularity, so this type is not allowed, and here is an example. There is a lovely theorem, which I wasn't meaning to show, but I'm showing because I'm an obedient, I obey orders, and it's the flower surgery theorem. So, the flower surgery theorem says that a knot is a ribbon knot if and only if it is the result of an n-petal flower surgery from thin petals to wide petals on an n-component unlink for some n. So let me explain. Here is a flower with n petals, n is equal to 4, and it's a flower of knots, and every component here, and it's in fact, if you think, so really it's a link, and if you look at it very carefully, it's actually the unlink. It's actually the unlink drawn in a funny way, right? You can sort of slurp in all of the petals, and you find that it's the unlink. Now, but still, it's the unlink presented, it's the unlink with four components, presented in such a way that the four components stick out as four petals in a certain way. And then the flower surgery is to replace these petals with these petals while keeping the tangle that appears in the middle the same way. And if you look at the result is now a knot, and in fact it's a ribbon knot. And the claim is that all ribbon knots arise in this way. So before telling you why this is relevant, first of all, Colin, are you happy?
I'm very happy.
Good. Stavros, are you happy? I've combined a honeybee in the picture. Good. So back to my story. So really what I'm saying is that there is a characterization of ribbon knots in terms of tangles. So here is a picture of a tangle, and the claim is that if you take a tangle and you close it in a certain way and you get the unknot, then another closure of it will be a ribbon knot. So that's a characterization of ribbon knots in terms of tangles. If you had a good invariant which is compatible with this closure operations, you can make a certain commutative diagram, and then if you read the text of that proposal, and you probably cannot do it because it's printed too small, but you have the URL, then you'll find why having this commutative diagram gives you a good chance of detecting non-ribbon knots. Okay? So that's the sketch. The point is that I want to apply this to pretty large knots, because the simplest potential counterexamples to the conjecture I want to disprove, slice equals ribbon, are pretty large. I mean, this is the simplest example I'm aware of, and it has 48 crossings. So, you know, if you think about computing its, colored Fovanov homology, come on, it's ridiculous. So we really need to find invariants that are computable in polynomial time. And also, we want our invariants to be extendable to tangles and compatible with the primary, most interesting tangle operation, which is stitching. So if you have a tangle, here is a tangle T, and it has one component called label A and another component label B. Stitching these two components is to just connect the end of A to the beginning of B and calling the result C. And if you think about it, everything that I described about surgery was really described in terms of these stitching operations. So I want my invariants to be compatible with this kind of stitching. Okay? Is everything okay so far? So, okay, good. Now I brute, basically because this is the only thing I know. You know, if I knew how to do things cleanly and elegantly, I would have. But I do what I know how to do. Okay? Now, I kind of know that at some point in the future, everything will become much cleaner and much elegant, but I live inside my own skin and in the present, and that's what I am. Okay. Okay, before telling you about the invariant that I want to find, I will tell you that the Alexander polynomial fits this pattern, is what I want. Except I already know it and I want something new. Okay? So the Alexander polynomial is somehow the gold standard for the kind of things that I want to do. And let me explain to you how the Alexander polynomial works in this context, how it extends to tangles, how it is very quickly computable. So, okay, for an S component tangle T, so when I say S component, S is a finite set, and what I mean is that each component is labeled by an element of that set. So if you have an S component tangle T, then it has an invariant which I will call gamma of T, and this gamma of T is belongs to RS direct times this Cartesian product S by S matrices over RS, where RS is a certain ring of polynomials. It's the of rational functions. So it's rational functions in variables T sub A, where the T sub A's are in a bijection with the elements of the set S of components of our tangle. So basically, gamma of T takes values in scalars cross matrices, and then the easiest way to denote such a combination, scalar cross matrix, is I'll call them the scalar omega, the matrix A, and I write it as a sort of omega as a sort of array like this, where omega appears on the upper left, A appears on the bottom right, and I'll put the labels, meaning the components, as a row here and as a column here, and these correspond to the rows and the columns of the matrix. Okay? So basically, the invariant of any specific tangle will be some combination such as here, where the scalar part appears here and the matrix part appears here. Now, to define such a... So I just told you where the invariant takes values, but now I have to tell you how to compute it. Okay? To compute an invariant, it's enough to compute an invariant for which there is a stitching formula. It's enough to define it on individual crossings, and to tell you how to stitch. Because basically every tangle is a combination of individual crossings via stitching. If you want to write a complicated tangle, first of all, you put down all the crossings of that tangle, and then you specify, let's stitch this to this. Then let's stitch this to this, then let's stitch this to that, and so on, and this way you can get arbitrarily complicated tangles. Okay? So I only need to tell you what the invariant of the crossings are and how to stitch. Actually, I also have to tell you how to take unions, because the first step is to take the union of several crossings. So the invariant of individual crossings are given as here. So if you have a single crossing with overcrossing with one component labeled A and one component labeled B, the invariant will be a 2x2 matrix because it has two components and a scalar. The scalar is 1 and the matrix is given here. 1 minus T A, the variable corresponding to the overstrand raised to the power plus 1, and 0 and then T A raised to the power plus 1. And if it's an undercrossing, then it's t to the power minus 1 instead of t to the power plus 1. Second, the disjoint union of two tangles goes to a certain operation where you multiply the scalar parts and you take the block diagonal sum of the matrix parts. It's kind of easy. And then last, and what appears to be hard but is in fact quite simple, is the stitching operation. So if you have a tangle like here with a component label A and a component label B, and you know it's invariant. And now you want to know the invariant of the tangle that you get by stitching A and B and getting C. Then what you do is, okay, first of all, you write the invariant of the original tangle as a big matrix. So the scalar part is omega, and then it's a big matrix whose columns are A and B, and then all the other potential components that may appear, and whose rows are A and B, and all the other potential components that may appear. And then here you have a big matrix whose coefficients are alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and all of these are really rational functions. And also theta, which is a row, and epsilon, which is a row, because it's sort of the row which you get by starting by looking at A and then all the other components. And likewise, phi and psi, which are columns, and then uppercase psi, which is an n minus 2 by n minus 2 matrix. It's sort of the remainder. And then the stitching operation simply takes this scalar matrix combination and converts it to this scalar matrix combination, which the only thing I can say about it is that it's written here explicitly. You may or may not like it, but it's a simple-minded formula. Okay? Now, it's actually an extremely good formula, even though it might look complicated. First of all, it's enough. I mean, you can compute the Alexander polynomial from it, because as I said, all you need is the values of the crossings, and you need to know how to do stitching, and this tells you what you need to do. And the second thing is that it's actually surprisingly efficient. And in fact, it's the most efficient algorithm that I know to compute the Alexander polynomial of a long knot, and therefore also of a round knot. So if you have a long knot, then it's a tangle, and then its invariant will have a scalar part and the matrix part. The matrix part will be 1 by 1 and not interesting. The scalar part will be omega, and this omega turns out to be the Alexander polynomial, and this is the fastest, and using this mechanism is the fastest way I know to compute the Alexander polynomial. In fact, how fast? So Nathan Dunfield implemented it in Python, and found that it's 1,000 crossing fast. So in other words, he computed, using this algorithm, he computed the Alexander polynomial for a large collection of random knots with up to 1,000 crossings, and it works, right? And you can compute efficiently such Alexander polynomials. Again, compare with categorified Pomfy or something. You'll never get to 1,000. Okay. Are you still with me? Maybe I'm too confused. Okay. So my hope is to replicate this, but with some other invariant, something new. Okay. Well, the Alexander polynomial is the real paradise, but the hidden paradise lies beyond it. Okay. Anyway, so the key is to use a certain theorem, which sort of can be attributed to a large number of people: Etting of Kashdan, my former student Ami Chaviv, Benjamin Enriquez, Pavel Severa, the theorem, in maybe except in the case of Chaviv, it's formulated in a completely different language. It's some theorem about a quantization of Libye algebras or quantization of infinitesimal young Baxter operators. Or in fact, I like to formulate it as there exists a universal finite type invariant for virtual knots, or for a certain class of virtual knots, to be precise, or virtual tangles, and this is the class, but again, I probably shouldn't go into the details. But let me simply tell you what the theorem says. It says that there exists an invariant Z of S component tangles, I mean, you can add the, you can be more specific about the type of tangles, but it's really not relevant. With values in some space, AV of S, which is a big space of diagrams, which should look familiar to people who studied the Kosiewicz integral, but it's a little bit different. So the diagrams look like, so they have red vertical bars in correspondence with the components of the tangles, of the tangle, and on top of that there is a graph made out of arrows, so directed edges, and if you compare with the Kosiewicz integral is the same except that the edges are not directed. And this fact that and this change to directed edges makes a big difference. And only two types of vertices are allowed. So the two types that are allowed are the bracket and the co-bracket vertices. So vertices in which two things enter and one thing exits, and they're called the bracket vertices, and vertices in which one thing enters and two things come out, and these are called the co-bracket vertices, and I'm forbidding sink or source vertices, so vertices in which everything's come in or everything comes out. And then you take this space of or you take the space of formal linear combinations of such diagrams, and you mod it out by certain relations which are written here. But I don't want to give too many details, but they're very much like the usual anti-symmetry STU and IHX relation of the Kosiewicz integral, except, and I didn't even mark it here, except the edges here should be oriented in certain specific ways. Okay? So you have an invariant inside this space, and that space carries the same operations that tangle carry. So basically you can take the disjoint union of two such diagrams. So if you have two such diagrams, you can put them side by side in a disjoint, in a non-interacting way. And also, if you have such a diagram, you can turn it, basically you can stitch ends. So, you know, you can connect the top of one red strand to the bottom of another with another sort of a red connector and then rearrange things combinatorially, and that's the stitching operation. And the theorem says not only that there is an invariant valued here, but there is an invariant which is compatible with these stitching operations and with this joint union. So therefore, it is enough to know this invariant on the single crossing, because that determines everything else via stitching and disjoint union. So that sounds wonderful, and indeed it is wonderful, except it's way too hard still. And the reason is, well, if you think about the combinatorics of such graphs, the number of such graphs grows, in fact, worse than just exponentially. I mean, but let's just call it exponentially. So the number of such graphs grows so quickly that no way you can compute this invariant below, beyond the first few degrees, beyond the output into very small graphs. So it's still too hard. So the idea is to try to look for quotients of this tangles of this target space, so quotients of AV, which first of all will be quotients by ideal in the appropriate sense. So you know, an ideal is what you mod out a ring by to get a new ring. So it's not just an arbitrary equivalence relation, it's an equivalence relation which is somehow compatible with the structure in the appropriate way. So similarly, I want to mod out this space by certain ideals that will preserve the stitching operations, that will keep the stitching operations well defined. Again, I can be precise about what this means, but just keep in mind that I'm only allowing myself a certain type of well-behaved quotients. And then I'm looking for quotients that are have polynomial size, that when I raise the complexity of the diagram, when I'm allowing more and more vertices, I want the dimension of the quotient by these ideals to grow at most polynomially, because if it grows more than polynomially, there's no chance that I'll be able to compute anything. Okay? So the first idea for, it's basically a zoo. So you can, if you kind of stare at these diagrams for a long time, you find that there are many, many, many quotients that you can think of. And then, and in fact, I did spend a few years, in a way, looking at various quotients of this space of diagrams in the hope of finding one that works. And so basically, there is a skip of a few years between the previous box and this box. This is the box where I tell you what quotient I know will actually work, and it took a long time to find. So, okay, there is the one co and the two quotient, on the two co quotient, also known as the Taylor's commute or the Taylor's commute squared quotient, and both are appearing on the right. So the one co quotient says, let's mod out by diagrams that have a co-vertex. If you remember, the diagrams here had two types of vertices. They had bracket vertices and co-bracket vertices. So the first quotient you can think of is, let's kill all the co-bracket vertices. Let's restrict to diagrams that only have bracket vertices. So this is the one correlation written here. If you mod out by the one correlation, the result, well, basically the only diagrams you can still write are either wheels, so circles in which are oriented in a certain way and into which lots of arrows enter, but nothing can exit because that would require a co-bracket. So basically these are the diagrams that you can write, and the tips, the ends of those incoming hair, which go into the wheel, must be connected to the skeleton of the diagram, to the red pieces, the vertical bars that appear here. So, or you can, the other thing you can write, so the only thing, two things that you can write are the first two things that appear in this list. So the other thing you can write is trees, which have a head and lots and lots and lots of tails, and everything flows towards the head. And again, these trees are placed within the skeleton by connecting all the ends of such a tree to the red pieces. Okay? So I spent a long time studying the one co-quotient, the quotient in which only this remains, and it's a sequence of papers by myself and Zhujana Dancho, and also by myself alone, knotted balloons and hoops and all sorts of that. And the point is that out of this arises the Alexander polynomial and the pretty form and the useful formula, maybe not pretty, but useful formula for the Alexander polynomial that I described before. Okay, and then there is the two co-quotient, and the two co-quotient is simply, you say, let's mod out by diagrams that have two co-bracket vertex. So you're only left with diagrams that have zero or one co-bracket vertices. And then, if you look at which diagrams you can write, well, there are five more diagrams that you can write. So, basically, a pitchfork with some hair, well, these five diagrams. This is actually manageable, in principle. But it's still exponential, because the hairs here in each of these diagrams, each individual hair can connect to a different component. So really, you know, out on the ends here, there is a labeling of which component it connects to, And so then there is a non-commutative word of labels appearing as the sort of, if you read these ends in order, and that's an exponential size space. So it's manageable, but still way too big for my purposes. And then the next idea is to use the 2D relations, which would restrict it to whatever might come from the Jones polynomial, and hence here's a picture of von Jones reading a book on the Dead Sea. You just reminded me that the picture was taken in the Dead Sea. And these relations say essentially the following. So I should have told you when I talked about these diagrams that they represent formulas that make sense in an arbitrary Levi algebra. So if you've seen how finite type invariants correspond to formulas that make sense in an arbitrary metrized algebra, then in a similar way, these correspond to formulas that make sense in an arbitrary Levi algebra, finite dimensional Levi algebra. Basically, the bracket vertices end up corresponding to the bracket of the Levi algebra, and the co-bracket vertices end up corresponding to the co-bracket of the Levi algebra, and everything else is standard. Okay? So the idea is, let's mod out by relations which somehow say that the 2D Levi algebra that we're studying that the Levi algebra that we're studying is at most two-dimensional. So two-dimensional vector spaces have the property that their second wedge power is one-dimensional. So basically if you have a tensor in a two-dimensional vector space, or an element in a two-dimensional vector space, basically if you have two anti-symmetric combinations in V squared, where V is two-dimensional, then they must be proportional to each other. And then there is a diagrammatic thing that corresponds to it. So if this square box with a wedge in it corresponds to anti-symmetrization, so it basically means that you take that basically either the lines pass through or minus what you get by switching the two lines. So this is an anti-symmetrization box. Then two anti-symmetric boxes are proportional no matter what is written on the other side. So that's somehow a diagrammatic way of saying that the Levi algebra that we study is two-dimensional. And hence so modding out by the 2D relation would mean to mod out by the relation saying that if you anti-symmetrize the inputs to a bracket vertex, what you get is proportional to the thing written here, which doesn't have a lovely wordish description, but it's still anti-symmetric with respect to the inputs. Likewise, you can anti-symmetrize the output of a co-bracket vertex, and there is some combined anti-symmetrization, which maybe I should skip. But these are the 2D relations. If you mod out by the 2D relations, the space drops to being polynomial size. And the reason is that basically, for example, this relation allows you to get rid of all the bracket vertices, and this relation allows you to get rid of all the co-bracket vertices at the cost of bubbles. So basically you end up replacing all vertices in a diagram by bubbles, And then you give bubbles a name, so you call a bubble connecting to strand number to strand number I, you call it BI, and then over the ring of power series in the bubbles, all that you could possibly have left, it turns out, is the diagrams written here. All that remains from the five diagrams written before is the however many diagrams that you have written here. And this is as a module over the ring of power series in the bubbles. Now this is a poly-size vector space, module. And once it's of poly-size, meaning polynomial in the degree, you can expect that the operations that you will have to perform on it will take polynomial time. And indeed they do, and I obviously spent too much time talking about flowers because I ran out of time, and I didn't tell you about, first of all, the solution of Young-Baxter that you can write in this space, and this is where brute force came in. This is a lot of brute force goes into this formula. And what's worse is that I didn't tell you about how to actually implement these operations. So the stitching operations in particular are sort of, there are lovely stories about how they're implemented, but they don't fit in the minus minute and 17 seconds that I have. And I also can tell you that there is also a quantum algebra related to it, related to this, but it's a bit non-standard because it's about bi-algebra rather than, and not even semi-simple things, rather than the semi-simple things that usually arise in quantum algebra. And I did tell you that it leads to some new representations of the braid group and the virtual braid group, but you know, on the other hand, here is a complete implementation of these representations, so you can just read out what they do. I'll stop. Polynomial, this omega thing. I didn't tell you how to read off the multivariable Alexander polynomial, but you can read out the multivariable Alexander polynomial from these formulas as well.
Does Nathan's program do that?
I don't know. Mine do. But mine are written in Mathematica and are way slower.
What happens if instead of the one co bracket, you put the one bracket to zero?
There is a certain duality.
So you get the same thing?
There is a certain symmetry. You'd get the same thing, essentially. But, so it's not more or less interesting. It's an arbitrary choice.
Yes. All right, let's thank our speaker again.
And some petit annonce. Okay, so the talk by Henry Lettner is switched with the Lynn Kipling of Friday because Ken was not feeling so well, so Lynn will be delivering the next talk. Also, let me say, let me just give you a plan for today so that you start preparing. We will be going to Thermal Springs. And then in the nearby beach, 5 minutes, Zafaro Beach. Okay, so we have lunch a bit earlier, I think, today. Right after lunch, we go down to the gate of the academy, and the coaches will be waiting there to take us to thermal springs. Here, they will show us around and guide us and so on. If anyone wants to stay and swim in the springs, they can do. They have a very nice swimming pool. But mind you, you should have towels. And also, mind you that you may have to stay with your bathing suits wet for the 5 minutes that you will be taken to the beach of Sahara. But people can stay if they want. Here, at the beach, this is an organized class. There are umbrellas and chairs. You can use them. Whatever you order has to be arranged privately. But after the swimming, around, I guess around 5:30, 6 o'clock, something like that, the municipality of the town of Zaharo will offer us a little something there, as a, I don't know, beverage, I don't know what, a small puzzle, ice cream, I don't know what they have prepared. Okay, and then around 7:15, we'll be heading back. This is the plan, okay?
Sorry. You said at some point that people who do not eat lunch here will or will not be able to eat lunch today. There was some special day where you could have lunch here if you wanted. Was it today or on Friday or?
Friday.
No, I'm confused.
It's Friday.
Friday, okay.
But I
can find it, so I understand.
And you can buy t-shirts if you want now in tabs.